A symbol of the old West is under threat, or a pest is threatening the new West, depending on who you ask. The Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, says it may have to begin killing wild horses to deal with a surplus of horses in holding facilities. It's one option on the table as the Bureau faces rising costs and budget cuts. And it's prompted wild horse advocates to rally around the animals. NPR's John McChesney reports from Nevada, where half of the nation's wild horse population lives.
Someone whispers, "Here they come." And over a mile away, a small plume of dust can be seen against sage-covered mountains, followed by flashing helicopter blades. Soon, dark dots emerge on the valley, then flowing manes and tails as the chopper pilot herds the racing horses into a funnel-shaped trap. A wrangler releases a so-called Judas horse, who's trained to lead the wild ones into the final approach to the trap. The captives mill about, wild-eyed and confused. They look sleek and in good health. In the holding pen, a mare aggressively protects her foal. Glenna Eckel is a wild horse specialist with BLM.
There's a social hierarchy here, you know, of different family bands, and now we've got them all mixed together in this kind of a situation where they're getting kind of rustled around.
Whoa.
Yoo-hoo, mama.
That whack you heard was a mama rearing up and delivering a double-hoofed kick to an encroaching mare. That's one way the new hierarchy is decided here. BLM captures about 10 to 12,000 horses a year, about half of them in Nevada alone. Not enough, according to ranchers. Too many, according to animal rights activists. And Glenna Eckel says letting Darwinian nature take its course with the wild horse won't work, because it has no natural predator, and populations double every 4 years.
Well, yeah, horses die, but before all that happens, you've potentially ruined your soils, you've destroyed your plant communities. The wildlife and the other critters that rely on this country are probably long dead or moved out of the country. We have got to balance the horses with the other animals. It's a bigger, more complex picture than just horses.
Those other critters are deer and elk and, of course, cattle. We'll get to those critters in a minute. BLM faces another dilemma. What to do with all the horses now in captivity? 30,000 of them, nearly equal to the number still in the wild. This is the Wild Horse Adoption Center in Palomino Valley, just north of Reno, Nevada. Horses here are thrashing about in a steel-walled channel that leads them to a veterinarian station where they'll be vaccinated, dewormed, and branded with a cold iron dipped in liquid nitrogen. There are 1,000 formerly wild horses here. Susie Stokey is with the BLM.
Our adoption market's clearly down. It's been on a downward trend for the last decade. We used to adopt around 8,000 animals annually. And certainly the economy, fuel prices, hay prices, all those things are having a factor in terms of our adoption market.
So the Bureau is looking at unpopular options like euthanasia.
Or even possibly considering options like sale without limitation.
That's a Bureau euphemism for selling horses for slaughter. Dr. Michael Kirk is an equine veterinarian with the Nevada Wild Horse Commission, who believes euthanasia should only be used to prevent suffering.
I think it's a cop-out to use euthanasia as a convenience to cut down numbers of healthy horses, if you will. To me, the public's not going to stand for it.
One public group that's not going to stand for it is the Animal Welfare Institute. Chris Hyde speaks for the Institute.
The reason we're in this position is simply because of horrendous management of the program by the Bureau of Land Management. We've been screaming about this for decades, that the system is broken, that they're not managing it properly. And, you know, sadly, in the last 10 years, it's gotten even worse because of their proposal to do mass roundups.
Hyde and others say the BLM has a built-in conflict of interest, that it's a tool of cattlemen who graze cows on the same public land used by wild horses. Third-generation rancher Ron Cherry is president of the Nevada Cattlemen's Association. He says BLM's gatherings must continue.
Right now, the West, and in particular Nevada, is facing a drought. Stopping these gathers would lead to the ranges being overused. It would lead to horses starving. It would lead to horses dying for lack of water. It just isn't something that the public would want to see, and it's not something that ranchers would want to see.
BLM and others are no doubt counting on public pressure to increase the budget for care of this national symbol. Meanwhile, a lot of fine horses remain in BLM corrals waiting for someone to adopt them. John McChesney, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Deborah Amos. Here's a word you don't often hear in the morning, dystopia. And it describes the miserable world created by German filmmaker Fritz Lang in his science fiction classic movie, Metropolis. Now, for the first time in more than 80 years, movie lovers and film historians will be able to see the complete 1927 epic. Over 20 minutes of missing footage was recently discovered in Argentina. Metropolis is about inequality, and Lang's silent film, A Magnificent City, is built on the backs of an underground world of slave laborers. Metropolis influenced modern science fiction movies from Star Wars to Blade Runner. But back in 1927, the movie wasn't a hit, and it was trimmed to make it more acceptable to audiences, and over time, those missing minutes were lost until now. With me from Buenos Aires is Paula Felix Didier, director of the Museum of Cinema. She found the complete version of Metropolis in her museum's collection. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Talk to us about that moment when you realized that you had made the discovery.
A film collector and a film historian, Fernando Peña, he happens to be my ex-husband, he tipped me off. He was the one who had a piece of information that led us to believe that what we had was probably a longer version of Metropolis. What we found is a 16-millimeter negative. So if you're familiar with 16-millimeter, you know that it's a very, very small frame, and it's a negative. So it's not very easy to see what's going on. So we just pulled out the film, and we looked it against the light, and we started pulling out reels until we found one that has a complete sequence that we knew it was not there in the other version.
So you were seeing images that you knew were in the shortened version, and then you were seeing something extra that you knew you had the real thing.
Yes, and when we found it, it was, oh my God, this is it.
For people who maybe don't know the movie, haven't seen the movie, make some comparisons about how important it is to find 20 minutes of a film like this.
With this movie in particular, the thing is that it was not only shortened, but the editing was changed. So although we have two completely new sequences, there are also lots of inserts and new scenes and shots that were not there in the other version. And in a way, it changes the fact that the film is about a love story and only a love story. This makes it much more complex, and in a way, it makes it much more of a Fritz Lang film than it was before.
Why is Metropolis such an important movie, do you think?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't think Metropolis is a great film, and by all means, it's not Fritz Lang's best film. But I think that it's very significant because of the way it made it into popular culture. There's no question that every other science fiction film made afterwards owes something to Metropolis imagery or even the plot of Metropolis. You find it in very unexpected films that Metropolis is still a huge influence.
You have an amazing archive there. You were on a distribution list from the 20s on. Have you found other films in that archive?
We found three more Argentine silent films that were lost. And this is a lot because there are maybe 10 Argentine silent films remaining. So three more is actually like 30% more. And I can't confirm it yet, but we also have some other international films that are considered to be lost. Nothing as major as Metropolis, of course. I think it's the holy grail for film archives. It's interesting. I had people asking me, do you feel like Indiana Jones? And and my answer to that is, yes, I do, but every film archivist is a little bit of an Indiana Jones.
Paula Felix Didier is the director of the Paulo Ducros Museum of Cinema in Buenos Aires. She recently found more than 20 minutes of missing footage from the silent film Metropolis. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
There's an old saying that writers sometimes hear, and it's write what you know. Stella Remington knows the real world of secret intelligence, counterterrorism, and counterespionage. For nearly 30 years, she worked for MI5, Britain's domestic intelligence agency, rising through the ranks to become the first woman appointed director general. Stella Remington is now retired from spy work, and she's turned her hand to spy fiction. She came by our New York studios to talk about her new book. It's called Illegal Action. Stella Remington, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's start with your main character, Liz Carlisle. Give us a portrait of who Liz is.
Well, Liz is a mid-30s intelligence officer working in MI5, and she finds herself up against a plot coming out of Russia, which is directed against one of what we call the oligarchs, the very rich Russians who are living in London in large numbers, and one of them is under threat from Moscow. And she is a very determined young lady who is anxious, always desperate, to sort of get to the meaning of the intelligence which she is working on. She finds it quite difficult, though, because she is sometimes patronised by some of the men around the place, and she is determined that she's not going to be patronised in this way. So she fights back in a fairly sparky way. She brings also a kind of, a female intuition, I would say.
Exactly. I was going to remark on that. She gets these moments where she figures something out.
She's got this sort of cool analytical intelligence, but then added to that is this female intuition that enables her to be the first to actually get to the solution.
You write about Liz's time with her bosses in the office, some of them who put her in harm's way because they don't give her all the information she needs. Now, at some moment, she goes to one of her bosses and he dismisses her concerns and he says, "If you're frightened, just say so." Can you read a little bit about her response?
Yes. Liz could not believe her ears. Of course she was frightened. What sane person wouldn't be? When she'd read about Tutti's death in the bath, she'd remembered something else, that unpleasant pool of red in her bath at the hotel in Cambridge. But she wasn't going to mention that to Brian. She was damned if she'd give him the satisfaction of thinking she couldn't cope. She felt so outraged that she could hardly trust herself to speak.
And how much of Liz is Stella?
Clearly, some of her is me. And certainly when I first joined MI5, it was a male-dominated world and I had to fight quite hard, to sort of hold my own in the same way she does. And I take some pleasure, I must say, in putting things into Liz's mouth that I might quite have liked to have said, but probably never did, when I was in her position.
It was a surprise to me to read, and I'm assuming this part is true, that there are so many Russian oligarchs who have moved to London, and so this plot can revolve around them. Is it a surprise to you that Americans don't often know that London now has plenty of Russian oligarchs living there?
Yes, I was quite surprised, but certainly in London, many of the best houses, the soccer teams, the best works of art have been bought up by Russians who got very rich under Yeltsin when some of the state enterprises were sold off. And they have come to London and they are spending their money in London. And in fact, I was working on my plot when Alexander Litvinenko, who is not an oligarch but is an ex-KGB officer.
And a dissident.
When he was murdered in an extremely unpleasant way by having polonium put in his tea. And he took a long time to die, and in dying, he said that he was quite convinced that this was a plot by his former colleagues in the KGB. And so I felt somehow that fact had caught up on fiction when that happened.
Life was imitating art.
Absolutely.
You are writing in a country that has a fairly strict Official Secrets Act. Do you find that you have to be very careful about what you reveal in your fiction?
Well, I still have to submit my fiction for clearance by my former colleagues to make sure that I haven't inadvertently revealed something that might be damaging to their current operations. But the truth is that the further I get away, you know, from what's actually going on, the less I know of the detail of what's happening, so the less likely it is that I'm going to reveal something damaging. But, you know, sometimes inadvertently I've used a name or a place that is current and they've asked me to change it. Which I do gladly, of course.
There's a real world debate over whether terrorism should be treated as a law enforcement issue. And there's different views about that between your country and the United States. Do you have an opinion? Do you come down on either side in how this fight against terrorism should go?
Well, in my opinion, terrorism is both a law enforcement issue and an intelligence issue. And in the United Kingdom, our intelligence services don't have any law enforcement powers, so they work very closely with the police. But it's essential, I think, to have intelligence. You've got to try and find out in advance what's being planned if you're going to be able to prevent it. And that's what goes on in the United Kingdom. The intelligence services are working very hard to infiltrate these groups and to try and find out in advance what they're planning. And then, on the basis of intelligence now, people are arrested. One of the problems is that you then have to turn intelligence into evidence if you're going to be able to prosecute people in court. And there's a big debate going on in the UK at the moment about how long people who are suspected of terrorism should be allowed to be held before they are actually charged, while the police try to turn the intelligence into evidence. And that, you know, this is a big civil liberties issue in the United Kingdom at the moment.
And in your fiction, it's noteworthy to see how close cooperation there is between even local police, the intelligence agencies. This couldn't happen in an American spy novel.
No, but it is an accurate representation of how things go on in the United Kingdom. And I think it's absolutely essential. Both our Foreign Intelligence Service, MI6, and MI5, which is the domestic service, and the police all work extremely closely together. And now they have a sort of joint unit working together so that the intelligence can be shared and the action on the street can be taken.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Stella Rimington is the former Director General of MI5, Britain's domestic intelligence agency. Her new spy thriller is called Illegal Action, and you can read an excerpt at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Competitive sport is war without gunfire. Those words appear in a paper that was co-written by someone who should know, Fan Hong, a Chinese academic and former national swimmer. In order to wage sporting battles, Beijing has poured money into training elite athletes. Even as market forces drive China's economy, its sports system remains a part of another era. In the first of a week-long series on sports in China, NPR's Louisa Lim profiles a school known as the cradle of Chinese gymnastics.
7 minutes, calls out a girl, as sweat drips down her brow onto a watch between her hands on the floor. She's the timekeeper, counting down a 10-minute-long handstand for this group of child gymnasts. Here they're part of a glorious tradition. Three Olympic gold medalists got their start doing handstands at this very school in Xiantao, Hubei province. All the staff here work for the General Administration of Sports. And Headmaster Tianhua says the school is an integral part of the sports system.
Our Chinese sports system is like a pyramid. We're the base, the fattest part of the pyramid. The middle of the pyramid is the professional provincial teams, and the national team is the apex. Our main role is to choose future athletes.
And that process can be brutal, even at this stage. China's sports schools are part of the machinery of state, designed to produce gold medalists no matter the human cost. I've trained until I cried many times, one small boy tells me. Sometimes we have to stand on our hands for half an hour. It's only hard at first, another boy says breezily. Then you get used to it. Coach Zheng Hunsheng, however, denies the children have to do half-hour handstands, although he admits that used to be the case. Their young bones are too soft to withstand such punishing exercise, he says. Gymnastics in any country is a tough and painful sport, and Beijing's sports machine has generally had a bad press. Yet some argue that professional Chinese athletes are in some way more fortunate than their Western counterparts, particularly as they're paid a government salary.
Financially, their life is probably a bit easier than most athletes, at least in the U.S. Most Olympic athletes in the U.S. Are still supporting themselves by college scholarships or other jobs. The result in China is that athletes can concentrate fully on their training.
Susan Brownell is a sports anthropologist from the University of Missouri, who actually trained as a college athlete both in the U.S. and in China.
Life seemed a little bit easier as a Chinese athlete. They seemed to me a little bit more pampered because of the fact that you did have people who cared about your physical and psychological well-being, taking care of you. If I needed a massage, I could get a massage. You know, in comparison, in the U.S., a lot was left to me.
Even this remote gymnastics school, home to around 100 children aged 4 to 9, is a beneficiary of state largesse. It's gained funding of $14 million over the past decade. Indeed, China gears its system towards elite athletes. Investing in sport for the masses takes a distant second place. One official quoted by Xinhua News Agency concluded each Olympic gold medal cost Beijing around $7 million. And with its top-down centralized control, China's sports system is the last bastion of the socialist planned economy. According to Xiong Xiaozheng from the Center for Olympic Studies at Beijing Sports University, any large-scale reform has been delayed by the need to win medals at this year's Olympics.
Winning glory at the Olympics is costly. If these programs were run under the market economy, competition results would suffer.
Back at the school, as the pint-sized gymnasts do exercises in the playground, Li Shuhui watches anxiously. He's visiting his six-year-old twin girls. They speak once a week over the phone since he enrolled them into this boarding school. Their mother also is too far away to visit. It's hard, he admits, but worth it to fulfill his dream.
When I see Chinese athletes winning gold medals overseas, I'm so moved I can hardly describe it. So I'd like my daughters to win a gold medal to win glory for the country.
That's the lure of gold and glory. For that, hundreds of thousands of parents press their precious only children into lives of sporting servitude. Li Shuhui says if his twins fail at gymnastics, he'll move them to diving. These words are a tacit admission. On the battlefield that is competitive sport, these children are little more than cannon fodder. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Xientao, Hubei Province, China.
To see what life is like for children inside a Chinese gymnastics school, you can view an audio slideshow on our website, npr.org. And from pint-sized gymnasts to retirees, tomorrow we'll meet some who sacrificed everything for the sport.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Jazz in Albuquerque, New Mexico may seem about as likely as a rain shower in that desert city. Well, while rain clouds are rare, jazz is flowing almost every day and night. So for the next story in our series on homegrown music scenes, we take you to Albuquerque. Reporter Paul Ingalls explains how the city's jazz culture was built gig by gig.
It actually did rain today, and the skies are iffy this evening. Charles Lowry knows the audience will come.
Oh, they'll be here. We're not worried about it. They'll get in their cars. They'll be here.
He's not worried because over the course of 15 years, the nonprofit New Mexico Jazz Workshop that he runs has built a solid audience with these weekend outdoor concerts at the Albuquerque History Museum. Tonight's band is Conjunto Colores, a Latin jazz and salsa ensemble from neighboring Colorado. The New Mexico Jazz Workshop began in 1976 as a collective of just eight musicians in nearby Santa Fe. who realized if they were going to survive as jazz players in the desert, they were going to have to hustle gigs and educate an audience. So they put on summer shows at a small town ball field between Santa Fe and Albuquerque and started a Concerts in the School series. Enter Boston-raised avant-garde saxophonist Tom Guralnick, who briefly held the reins of the workshop in its earlier days, and then returned in 1985 with an idea that would transform the scene.
My idea was, in being here, that I would start another organization that did different kinds of experimental music and world music, and then later jazz. Key to what I wanted to do was to have a small performance space, like some of the places that I'd been to in Europe.
What he settled on was small. A storefront a block south of the legendary Route 66.
This was a print shop. It was owned by two brothers, the Furry Brothers, believe it or not. And they built an apartment upstairs for their mother to live in.
Like most jazz musicians, Guralnick wasn't rich. He sold his house to raise the money to buy the place and moved into the upstairs apartment. Below, he created a 90-seat nonprofit listening room, not a club. He called it the Outpost Performance Space.
We set it up as a long, narrow space where people would only be three rows from the stage. You know, maybe it wasn't the perfect performance space, but it was what we had.
Over the course of 10 years, with the help of some large grants, Guralnick was able to turn the Outpost into a tour stop for internationally known jazz musicians. The late soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy and trombonist Roswell Rudd played here in 1999. Lacy came to the Outpost a number of times from his home in Paris, and he wasn't alone. Pianist and composer Vijay Iyer, who's on the cover of this month's Downbeat magazine, says the reason is simple. People here come to listen.
Most of these venues, like, you know, if you go to some of the clubs in New York, these are great places to play, but you're always competing with what's on the menu. I mean, if every state in the United States had one venue like this, the entire landscape would be totally different.
The landscape in Albuquerque has been carefully designed to build a supportive audience base. From the beginning of the jazz workshop, education for adults and young people was part of the plan.
So I'll give two bars and a downbeat. Ready? Everybody gets a chorus.
Those efforts continue today with classes presented by both the workshop and the Outpost.
One.
One of the products of the Albuquerque scene is 25-year-old bass player Matt Brewer. He went to shows and took classes at the Outpost and started playing professionally when he was 12. Now he's one of Manhattan's most sought-after bassists.
All the bass players in New York that I've spoken with about Albuquerque have been really impressed with their time there. I mean, I think because the audiences are really attentive, and shows are often packed full of people, and I think people can tell that the organizations that are bringing shows in are run by people who actually have a passion and love for the music.
It's certainly not to get rich, says the Outpost's Tom Guralnick.
Club owners or nonprofit organizations are not making a lot of money. Musicians are not making a lot of money. And we all support each other. You know, we're all in it for the same reason. And in fact, all of my colleagues, jazz presenters, have been or still are musicians. I would say 90% of them. That's why we got into presenting music, because we believed in the music and know what it's about to be playing music.
The jazz scene thrives in New Mexico because of the steady dedication of each member of the jazz community, says the workshop's Charles Lowry.
To help keep alive the education of young people as well as adults so that they appreciate, understand, and support live music. I think that's precisely why we're in it. We know it has made and continues to make a difference in the lives of people, and it's good work. It's meaningful work.
Because of those efforts, good musicians can keep busy enough to at least pay the mortgage, which is a lot cheaper here than in New York or Los Angeles.
When I moved here, I realized that I could do anything that I wanted to do in the field of music.
Dave Parlato moved here in 1990. He had been a top session bassist in Los Angeles, playing with everyone from Mose Allison to Frank Zappa. But he says in L.A., that's all he was. Here, he not only plays his own music, he also directs the Outpost's education program.
I could wear many more hats here, and it would be okay. I formed a big band here at the old Outpost and had that band for 4 years. I would have never even thought of doing that in Los Angeles.
Parlato says New Mexico's vastness inspires his music. It did the same for jazz legends Herbie Mann, Kenny DeVerne, and Frank Morgan, who all chose to live and play out some of their final years here.
I don't know. New Mexico's a special place.
Outpost director Tom Guralnick.
I mean, it really is. We call it the land of enchantment, which then turns into the land of entrapment, you know? People come here thinking that they're going to stay for a while, and like myself, 30 years later, here I am.
This week, he'll be shuttling between Albuquerque and Santa Fe for concerts in the annual New Mexico Jazz Festival, which runs through July 28th. And features both the best of the local talent and a number of international stars. For NPR News, I'm Paul Ingalls.
At our website, you can hear performances from The Outpost and see a video about jazz in Albuquerque. That's in the music section of NPR.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Commentator Julie Zicafus rescues birds in distress as a licensed wildlife rehabilitator, and that may seem like a low-tech pastime. Here's her story of what happened when a pair of wrens met one of the most popular high-tech gadgets.
When a cascade of twigs, leaves, and rootlets appeared on the elbow of our downspout, I watched to see a little brown wren trying to make a great wad of nesting material stay on the slippery metal. I caught the bird's eye. "Wait right here. I'm going to help you." I ran to the garage, grabbed a little copper bucket, some wire, and a stepladder. I climbed the ladder, wired the bucket up under the eave, placed the nesting material in the little pail, and climbed down the ladder. The wren perched on the gutter just a few feet away, watching. Before I got the ladder folded, the wren appeared with a bill full of moss and put it in its new home. By nightfall, the nest was nearly complete. Since that day, 5 years ago, 30 or more baby Carolina wrens have been raised in the copper pail, and we've watched the fledglings flutter out time and time again, adding motion and music to our lives. There were 5 nestlings this summer, and they lined up on the downspout before making their first stuttering flights into the world. Well, 4 of them did. When Carolina wrens leave the nest, they don't mess around. One minute, everything's quiet. The next minute, baby birds are shooting out of the nest like popcorn. The parent birds work in shifts, calling and encouraging the young to hop and flutter to the nearest deep cover. Somehow, the adult birds keep them all together and feed them for the next 3 weeks as their wings strengthen and foraging skills develop. So I was alarmed to find one baby wren, all bright eyes and yellow clown lips, still perched by the bucket after its 4 siblings had gained the safety of the woods. Surely a parent would return for it. 1 hour, then 2 went by, and the fledgling was hungry, chirping constantly for help. Oh, dear, I did not want to be a teenage wren's mother for the next 3 weeks. I listened, nothing from the silent woods. By now, the family could be hundreds of yards away. What to do? It was time for a little technology. I grabbed my iPod, which is fully loaded with the songs and calls of nearly every North American bird. I ran to the edge of our woods and dialed up the song of the Carolina Wren. "Please, please, let this work." I played it at full volume. No response. Desperate, I dialed up the alarm call of the wren and blasted it down into the silent tangle of raspberry and sumac. Danger, danger, the recording shrilled in wren speak. An adult wren shot right past my head, flying straight toward the forgotten baby in the copper bucket. The recalcitrant fledgling buzzed out to meet it. Baby wren, last seen, headed toward the safety of the woods in the company of a parent. Nature geek, smiling broadly.
Commentator Julie Zickavus does whatever she needs to as a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. She lives in Whipple, Ohio.